are spending from 1.4 to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car, we're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem. Yeah,
when I drive with a car or something, and the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continue, there will be problem, because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping if you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Memorial service held to pay tribute to a major figure in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, late Lieutenant General Mohammad Hejazi. Hejazi was the deputy commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. The top general died last year after years of battling the effects of exposure to chemical agents in Iraqi gas attacks during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
General Hejazi was on the front line of the fight against the occupying Israeli regime. He was highly skilled in scouting for and training members of the resistance. The likes of General Hejazi and General Soleimani trained many resistance members who have turned into flag bearers of the resistance axis.
Hejazi's name goes hand in hand with Major General Qasem Soleimani, an anti-terror military commander who was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in January 2020. IRGC officials say Hejazi stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria.
When it comes to the fight against Daesh terrorists, General Hejazi played a key role in training the resistance fighters both physically and ideologically to readily fight the terror group. He led several operations that dealt heavy blows to the terrorists.
General Hejazi joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps during the early days of its establishment in 1979. He was a veteran of the eight-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, before being appointed as the head of the Basij, a paramilitary force affiliated to the IRGC. Hejazi also served as an intelligence and security advisor to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He became the deputy commander of the Quds Force in late January 2020, after the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. He was on the list of the U.S. and Europe sanctions as part of bans imposed on the IRGC.
From serving in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s to fighting terrorism in the region, General Hejazi grew to become a vital piece in the IRGC's activities, so that the military force still mourns his death as a huge loss. That's, quote, irreplaceable. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A hearing to review the case of a Palestinian prisoner has been held at an Israeli court. After the hearing, the court said Ahmad Manasra's case doesn't apply under terrorism laws. This means his lawyers can appeal for his release. Mona Khandil reports from Ramallah.
Ahmad Manasra, this Palestinian youth, who was arrested 6 years ago when he was only 13 years old, is suffering mental health issues due to torture and solitary confinement he faces in Israeli jail. Ahmad's lawyers had appealed to the Israeli court against a special prison committee's rejection of a request to have Ahmad's case reviewed by a parole committee after he had served two-thirds of his sentence. The Israeli court of Bir al-Sabah held a hearing to review Ahmad's case. They only decided that his case doesn't come under the terrorism law.
Ahmad Manasra is an example of the persecution of children in Palestine. He's a child who was arrested while he was 13 years old only. He was persecuted, he was oppressed, he was tortured, and he was frightened, and he has become a victim of physical and psychological abuse from the Israeli side. That's why there is a huge campaign now demanding his release.
After years of his detention, no one can forget the video of an Israeli interrogator violently questioning a Palestinian child. In the video, Israeli interrogator kept screaming at Ahmad and accusing him of lying. Ahmad repeatedly told the interrogator that he couldn't remember. Ahmad was referring to the day when Israeli settlers opened fire at him and left him bleeding on the ground after being run over by an Israeli settler's car. Israeli settlers cursed him, damning him to death. This came after his 15-year-old cousin Hassan was shot dead by Israeli settlers. They accused both Ahmad and Hassan of attempting to carry out a knife-stabbing attack.
The Israeli committee originally rejected looking into Ahmad Mansara's file on the basis that its case falls under the terrorism law. Now, after the latest ruling, Ahmad's lawyers want to request to have his case reviewed by a parole committee. He has served 6 of his 9-year sentence and is suffering from mental health issues.
A global solidarity campaign has pressured the Israeli courts to hold a hearing to review and possibly appeal Ahmad's case.
The Israeli court has only decided to cancel the previous decision that Ahmad Manasra's case comes under the so-called terrorism law. However, Ahmad's family and lawyers hope that the next session will be soon, as there is a serious need to release Ahmad immediately due to his severely deteriorated mental condition. Mona Qandil, Occupied, Ramallah.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the cabinet room shortly after 2 p.m. lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, there's about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those who lost loved ones during COVID. And the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice. and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID. And now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger.
Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighbouring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Clashes at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan were one of the most violent. Israeli occupation forces attacked Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians, while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers. Isn't Al-Aqsa a place of worship for Muslims? Why then do they become a victim of Israeli violence? Meanwhile, condemnations have poured in from Iran to Saudi Arabia, with the EU and the US too have only expressed grave concern.
Tensions are high in the occupied territories amid a recent increase in crackdown on Palestinians. Regime forces attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday. Scores of Palestinians were wounded in the clashes. Around 400 people were also arrested. Muslim nations as well as resistance groups have condemned Tel Aviv. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Iran said Friday's events in Muslims' third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Analysts believe that Tel Aviv is intentionally increasing tensions to take control of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
I think that the Israelis are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war.
The clashes came after 3 weeks of deadly tensions in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv has deployed more forces to the West Bank and conducted raids and house searches there almost every day. This has resulted in the deaths and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given Israeli forces a free hand in their operations. Many believe that the latest escalation could turn into an uprising or a new intifada in Palestine.
Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could any time turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue.
Palestinians have also increased their operations in response to the crackdown. Since March 22nd, they have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving 14 Israelis dead. The increase in anti-Israel operations in the occupied territories show that Palestinians have reached a conclusion that they should decide their own fate, especially after several Arab countries normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan joins us from Ramallah. We also have writer, journalist, and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Amal Wahdan, and let's talk about what has occurred in terms of the violence part. And the reason why I'd like to start off with this is because we need to enlighten viewers and people watching as to how the Israeli forces used extreme, means here. Looking at the entire mosque that were raided by the Israeli occupation forces, firing live bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, preventing access to paramedics, and attacking the mosque guards, health workers, and media personnel, resulting in 150 Palestinians to have been wounded. What do you think about the tactics and the level of violence that was used by the Israeli forces?
Yeah, these tactics that they have used has surprised the prayers who were in Al-Aqsa Mosque since the raid came. Just after dawn, so people were not expecting a raid that early, but this is actually a part of their aggression measures, you know, increasing and escalating their measures against Palestinians. Not only this, the excessive use of arms, excessive use of tear gas and sound gas. Prayers did not expect this, so they took them in a sudden action, and it caused a lot of chaos, a lot of damage to the mosque, inside the mosque. Can you imagine, you know, anybody who's listening to us now, if a police force stormed into a church or a synagogue or a mosque in somewhere else in the Western world, this will become a real scandal, you know. They will call the ICC to investigate and take actions against the country, against the police forces. But in Palestine, the Israeli arms, the Israeli army, the Israeli special forces can do anything in any place. No boundaries for them to act like barbaric and like Nazis, actually. This is a fascist country. It was categorized as an apartheid state. And that last time, few days ago, Bennett has given the settlers and individuals the right to own guns and use these guns. We know that settlers in organized groups, they have their guns. They are like paratroopers to the Israeli army. But now they are giving a free hand to everybody to own arms. This is a call for war. And what happened in Al-Aqsa Mosque, actually, as your report showed, that they arrested people, hundreds of people. The number that we know is 400 people. But the injured were, the first count of injured were 250. Part of them were treated in Al-Aqsa Mosque, okay. Paramedics tent. And some of them were transferred to Al-Maqasid hospitals. 10 people yesterday were
critical condition.
Yes, in very critical condition, and others were hit in the eyes, for example.
Sure, and that's what I want to talk about even more. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, Hafsakar Mustafa, but videos showing worshippers lying on the ground, their hands tied behind their backs, children to be among the ones who are arrested. Worshippers beaten by Israeli police while evacuating. You know, the aggression here is so severe that it's skimmed over and when it's covered by the media. Meanwhile, Israel has attempted to spin the police raid, as they call it in Alaska, as an effort to protect the freedom of worship. So we can see who they're trying to serve and how they're trying to spin the story. Do you agree that they're doing that?
Well, of course not, but I think we have to put this into the current context, which is that the international media and international interest and focus is currently now on Ukraine. And what the Israelis do, and they routinely do this, is that when there's a major world event that is distracting world opinion, they will make the most of it by going on a killing spree of Palestinians. And that's exactly what they've done. They're literally making the most of this current war in Eastern Europe, which is attracting a lot of attention, and using it as an opportunity to carry out ethnic cleansing operations and operations inside places of worship that actually we wouldn't have seen Nazis do. I mean, for the past 70 years, we've heard of the horrors of the Holocaust and Nazi operations against Jews, but actually this puts Nazis to shame. This is far beyond what we've seen for 5 years happening in Germany. This has been going on for 70 years. This is an attack. These are war crimes. These are immoral crimes that should be condemned vehemently by the international community, and they're not, because Israel currently enjoys total impunity and is making the most of the situation which is distracting, public opinion is distracted by the war in Ukraine, and they're making the most of it, knowing that essentially only Middle Eastern media will actually take interest in what's happening, whilst obviously Western media is focused elsewhere.
Amal Wahdan, perhaps you can tell us why we are having this problem carry on for all these decades, which is what's been called the flashpoint of Al-Aqsa Mosque, sacred to Muslims. We know how Jews feel about that. Why has this been a flashpoint? What can be done to remove that status?
This apartheid state was created by the superpower, by the British first, and then sponsored and nourished by the USA and the NATO countries. So this apartheid country is above any law, above international law, above human rights law. In the UN Security Council, General Assembly, they can escape any impunity, any action to stop them. We cannot even take them to ICC. The most that we can do is bring an investigation to their crimes. So this is one part of why this state is carrying what it's doing right now. And storming in and raiding Al-Aqsa Mosque the way they did is an escalation to a situation that was going on before. You know, groups of settlers from different settlers, radical organizations have raided Al-Aqsa Mosque, not storming in, you know, walking in or making silence prayer. They took an order from the court that they can do silence prayer in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is inciting Muslims, and this is violating the Muslim rights of worshipping in their sacred shrines in Al-Aqsa Mosque. So barging into Al-Aqsa yesterday and raiding Al-Aqsa while, you know, worshippers were ready to go for the dawn prayer is something that cannot be tolerated. And even if there wasn't any war somewhere else like Ukraine, the international community would not even take a real measure. They will condemn, they will bring, you know, they will send some convoy delegations and delegations here, but they will not take action against this apartheid regime. Nothing is going to stop them. They are going to repeat what they did in Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So what happened is a big, you know, it's a flashing alarm towards the whole world. But for us Palestinians, we're continuing what we are doing right now. We're resisting. We're resisting these racist and discriminated system here. We're going to continue resisting.
Sure. Hafsakar Mustafa, one of the most interesting things, maybe not too much of a surprise, but yet enough of a surprise, are the demographics of some of the Palestinians that have actually protested recently. And I'm talking about in specifically what happened in Tel Aviv and also then other Palestinians who are not affiliated with the resistance groups like Hamas or the ones out of the Gaza Strip or even to the PA or any groups or any ideology. And they're coming out and they're protesting. What does that show when you're seeing Palestinians that have no affiliation of any kind coming out and actually carrying out what's been called resistance operations, which, well, the one in Tel Aviv is the one that was the most severe in terms of the results that came out of that?
Well, first of all, it does show that the Palestinian people are united in condemning the Israeli actions. But of course, it also shows that this is a problem that impacts all of Palestinian society, and it doesn't have to be exclusive to one political party. Of course, in the eyes of the Israelis and how they want to spin it, they would like to present that these actions made by Palestinians are exclusively reserved to groups that are affiliated to political parties. But actually, the upset is generalized and is across the board across Palestinian society, from all ages and from all social groups, and exactly from whether they are politicized or not. So I think this is a reflection of the upset that you have amongst Palestinians of all scopes, and I think it's mirrors the scale of the atrocity that's being committed. Obviously, this is not targeting militias or certain armed groups. This is targeting civilians who are going about their daily lives and inside places of worship, which makes it not only immoral, but actually and legally a war crime.
You talked about Amal Wahdan, about the settlers. Tell us, first of all, it's very alarming that you said that they are now allowed to bear arms. I don't have information on that, but that makes the situation rather very dangerous. Because if you can explain to us why it is that they are allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque sporadically at intervals, not really well thought out or well planned from what it seems, and they are given escort by the Israeli security forces. Can you please explain to us what that story is all about?
Well, first of all, the Islamic organization in Al-Aqsa Mosque has denounced the continuous storming into Al-Aqsa Mosque, settlers going almost each day, day in, day out. So the settlers took this to the court, and the court allowed them to do silence praying in Al-Aqsa, which means this is the first step for them, having silence prayer, then having real prayer inside Al-Aqsa, then sacrificing, performing sacrifices in Al-Aqsa Mosque as they wanted to do yesterday. Later on, splitting, time and space, just like in Al-Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So what they are doing is a gradual, step by step to occupy Al-Aqsa, and then do what's in their, what's in their mind, ruining Al-Aqsa. What happened yesterday has happened in 1969 when they burned Al-Aqsa. And it was really horrifying for all Muslims. Unfortunately, the Arab world has not reacted in the same, in the same level of this action. And they only condemned these massive storming in and raiding into Al-Aqsa. So what is needed to be done here is real action. And the people of Palestine had to decide that they are going to take the power into their own hands and they're going to defend themselves. What we have to remind the whole world that we are in a defensive position. Even when people like young people like Diya and like Raad infiltrate into Tel Aviv and do these operations, this is a normal reaction of self-defense. Mm-hmm. When there is a colonization power in a place, there are colonizers, colonized people who are going to resist. It's the course of history everywhere.
So let's go along those lines here. And Habsakar Mustafa, if we have Palestinians brave enough to go out there and to risk their lives, they need to somehow be backed. Now, we know Hamas has encouraged, for example, some of these Palestinians. But even apart from Hamas, some Arab countries need to do that. Now, the reactions that came on this Al-Aqsa raid, Iran, Iraq, Qatar, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Jordan, they all say that Tel Aviv must be held to account. But yet you have the European Union or the U.S. Who have said, well, this is of grave concern, and they call for an end to the immediate, an immediate end to the violence. The Arab support from the Arab countries, the leaders, it's not there the way it should be, is it?
No, not only is it not there as it should be, but actually the recent normalizations have even boosted Israeli actions because, of course, they're seeing that there is absolutely no consequence to what they're doing. Obviously, we know that they've got full backing of Western countries, so let's just put that aside for a second. But at the very least, there was a level of hostility from the Arab world, officially at least, over the years. Now, recently, with all these normalizations that have come from absolutely nowhere and for no reason and that bring nothing to these Arab countries, and particularly the wealthy Gulf states, for instance, which don't need money, this has actually boosted Israeli actions. And the very least we should see now, and perhaps there should be more pressure. Let's ignore Israel because it won't abide by any form of pressure. But I would hope to see pressure on these Arab/Muslim countries actually sever relations with Israel as a result of these actions. Because, of course, this violation of a mosque during Ramadan is absolutely unacceptable. It's unacceptable morally, regardless of where you are and who you are. But, of course, for Muslim countries, it's doubly unacceptable. Sure. And I think that we should put pressure on Arab countries to actually take a stand and say, well, no, normalization is no longer acceptable given what you've done. It should never have been acceptable, of course, but in these current situation, absolutely no. And there should be a severing of relations with Israel at this stage.
Amel Wahdan, a normal Palestinian who has no affiliation with anybody, goes out on the streets, risks his or her life, and then looks up to whatever respective countries, Arab countries, that are normalizing ties with Israel, such as what we saw in the Negev Desert recently. I mean, when Palestinians see that, do they lose hope, and that is why their anger is spilling out onto the streets?
Well, actually, we have seen this before. We know that the Arabs are not, supporting our struggle against this occupation, except for those who are in line with our resistance to the occupation, like Algeria, for example, resistance in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, Iraq to a certain degree during this time that they're going through. So the Gulf states have been in alliance with the USA for decades now, and they used to have relations with the Israelis, but it was under the table. Now they have advanced their ties with Israel. So this will cause more resilient and more willingness from young people to do what they are doing, because they've been living under miserable conditions for decades.
Sorry to cut you off. We're just fresh out of time. Thank you very much for your insight, Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and Palestinian activist. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, thank you, writer, journalist, and political analyst from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batagwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In addition to targeting Muslim communities, the staunchly pro-Israel Macron has used similar repression against supporters of Palestinian rights, says Ali Abu Nima, journalist, in an article titled "Emmanuel Macron Wages War on France's Muslims." Stay tuned for more. Recently, busloads of people traveled the 400 miles from Bordeaux to Paris. They went to the French capital to rally in support of their local mosque, the fate of which is being decided by the country's Supreme Administrative Court, the Conseil d'État, which held a hearing on the matter recently. Over the last year, the administration of Emmanuel Macron has been ordering the closure of mosques across the country, all based on such vague accusations as separatism and inciting hatred against France and the Zionist regime. In reality, these collective punishments are a response to how community leaders have expressed opinions the French government does not like. It's also a patent effort by Macron, who is up for re-election this month, to win votes from racists. As part of his ongoing anti-Muslim crackdown, Macron's Interior Ministry in March ordered the closure of 6 months of the Farouk Mosque in Pessac, a Bordeaux suburb. In addition to targeting Muslim communities, the staunchly pro-Israel Macron has used similar repression against supporters of Palestinian rights. In February, he ordered the dissolution of two French-Palestine solidarity groups. Muslims and other supporters of civil rights across France have been rallying against Macron's iron fist repression. The Farouk Mosque in Pessac challenged the Macron administration in court. In late March, the administrative court in Bordeaux overturned the closure decision, calling it disproportionate and a grave and manifestly illegal violation of the freedom of religion. The unjust order issued by the administration has been suspended, Goez stated following the victory, adding the Muslims of Pessac will be able to continue to gather in dignity as the holy month of Ramadan comes. But the Macron administration appealed the Bordeaux court's ruling to Conseil d'État. Following the hearing in Paris recently, Guez expressed hope that the Conseil d'État would uphold the Bordeaux decision. A ruling is expected next week. The order to close the mosque in Pessac is not based on any alleged terrorist act, but solely on a speech the Macron government does not like. Amnesty International called the closure of CCIF a shocking move from the French government and warned that it could have a chilling effect on all people and organizations engaged in combating racism and discrimination in France. So far, the French government has not moved to close down Amnesty International, although Macron has rejected the human rights group's finding earlier this year that the Zionist regime perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid against the Palestinian people. This extreme repression is being done in a country which markets itself as a champion of free speech. Macron has defended and supported the dissemination of hateful anti-Muslim propaganda in the form of cartoons, degrading the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in the name of liberty and enlightenment and freedom of the press. Meanwhile, his government recently issued a formal protest to Russia because Moscow's embassy in Paris tweeted out a now-deleted caricature criticizing the European policies. So much for freedom of expression. Macron is facing far-right leader Marine Le Pen in the country's presidential runoff election on April 24th. The president scored 27% in the first round against 23% for Le Pen. Left-wing leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon came close to third with 22%, but that was not enough to make it to the second round. Macron's interior minister, Gérald Darmanin, makes little secret that the government's anti-Muslim repression is aimed at winning votes. In a February TV debate, Darmanin attacked Le Pen for being soft on Islam and of going too far in your strategy of de-demonization. Darmanin also accused Le Pen's National Rally Party, formerly the National Front, of saying Islam is not a problem. Le Pen, looking surprised at being attacked from the right, responded, "I confirm that you don't hear me attacking Islam.
which is a religion like any other, and for which, because I am profoundly attached to our French values, I hope to protect the complete freedom to organize and the complete freedom to worship. There is every reason to doubt Le Pen's sincerity. Her apparent moderation is nothing more than a tactic to appeal beyond her traditional far-right base, which she must do if she has any chance of defeating Macron. But given its record, there is absolutely no reason to doubt the Macron administration's sincerity when it comes to its anti-Muslim policies.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.